Welcome to the Judge John Hodgman podcast. I'm Bailiff Jesse Thorne. This week we're in chambers clearing the docket. How are you, Judge Hodgman?
I'm great. It is a brand new year in the future relative to when we are recording this. When you are hearing this, Judge John Hodgman listeners, it will be the first week of a new year. I'm not going to say which year because I want these to be evergreen. I don't want them to seem dated. I don't want this to sound like a real 2016 podcast. You know what I mean? No, but it is now a new year, but we are recording this in the old year, at the very end of the old year, as the holidays, which are now in your memory, are just bearing down upon us, and I am in the thick of it. I am here in my chambers, sitting in my traditional waist-deep vat of eggnog, and just getting ready to dispense some justice at the year and some unfinished justice. Are you getting in the nog tank?
Do you mind if I get in the Naga? I didn't bring any swim trunks.
Oh, no. That's, you know, we nog it European style here, if you know what I mean.
Oh, thank goodness. So this is a Nog sauna?
It's a nude Nog sauna. It's very hot, and it has a lot of allspice. So if you have any sensitivities, you should sign this waiver.
Let's pour a little Nog on these hot stones.
I'm sure Mark McConville could have added some eggnog on hot stones sound effects, but in the spirit of the holidays, I'm just going to beatbox it. Ah. All right, now we should get into the other thing, which is the docket, right?
Here's something from Carrie. Each trip through a fast food drive-thru with my husband, Kurt, is unpleasant and awkward for both of us. He usually drives, and he's tasked with ordering the food. He becomes irritated when he must tell the restaurant employee my order. Instead, he makes me say my order into the microphone, which causes me and the employee undue stress. I end up having to lean over near the steering wheel and shout my order awkwardly to a person who's probably caught off guard by hearing a second voice. Kurt insists upon efficiency in every aspect of his life. He honestly believes this way to be more efficient because we skip the step in which I tell him my order and then he tells someone else. Judge, please issue a ruling. Whoever is the driver must do the ordering for the entire car at a drive-thru.
Well, first of all, I'm going to correct you right away, Carrie. I think hearing a second voice over the drive-through radio is probably the least alarming thing that someone manning a drive-through window has had to deal with. That probably you could drive through in the nude with your car on fire, and the person who is behind that window has probably seen that five times and will not care. So it's not. I appreciate your concern, as we all should have concern for the people who are doing the work for us in life that we choose not to do, such as deep frying the food and shoving it through the holes in our car to put into the holes in our mouth. So that's nice, but I'm not concerned that you're freaking out this young man or woman. I am a little surprised by your husband Kurt's insistence that you do the ordering yourself. Jesse, do you have an opinion before I give my verdict on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that while I understand her husband Kurt's need for efficiency, there are other ways to have an efficient order. I mean, I don't think typically that there is not a moment before you pull up to the drive-thru for her to share her order with him so that he can speak the order into the drive-thru microphone. There's got to be a moment when you're somewhere between your house and the microphone that she could be like, "Yeah, I want a double cheeseburger."
Yeah. I would hope that your life is balanced enough that there is some time that elapses between waking up in the morning and being at the drive-thru fast food place that you might be able to put your idea of an order in mind and convey it to your husband. I absolutely agree with you. The thing that puzzles me the most is this seems profoundly inefficient compared to simply Kurt hearing what you have to order and then ordering everything all in a row himself once he pulls up to the microphone. You're leaning over in the car. That's always bad when that happens. And you're probably dragging out the whole experience and I guess taking the risk of confusing, at the very least, the person who is serving you. And while it probably doesn't bother them to be confused, it might slow things down. The real thing that puzzles me, though, is Kurt, the privilege of driving is getting to do these things. You know, when you drive, you get to pick the music, right? We've established if you're driving, you get to pick the music. And when you pull into a drive-thru, you get to order for everybody, no matter what they want. For some of us in the world, it's the only time we have any semblance of control over our families. The rest of the time, we surrender. But when we are in the driver's seat, we are in the literal driver's seat. But it seems to me that by asking her to do this, he's giving up the great privilege of being the driver. So I don't know what's going on. I mean, that he is making you do this seems weird, and that you guys go to drive through fast food enough that it becomes an issue is another thing that I would caution you about. Maybe the solution should be to write down a few sample meals in advance on index cards that you keep in the car. You can have a different index card for each possible fast food restaurant you might go through. I would even advise making one for a Long John Silver. There's still some Arthur Treachers around, too. Cover every base. Have them in the glove compartment. This way, you can force Kurt to order efficiently without straining your voice or back. And it will also afford you the opportunity to write down the food that you are thinking about eating and realizing, oh, this is terrible. I don't want to do this. You know, these index cards will be a reminder to you that that you might want to invest some time in eating well-prepared food outside of your car if you have that opportunity.
Here's something from Grace. I'm writing in to ask you to settle a dispute between my fiancé and myself about the most appropriate way in which to receive gifts. My fiancé believes that you should accept every gift regardless of how you feel about it. I'm of the opinion that there are certain situations in which it would be appropriate to tell the gifter how you really feel. Here's the instance that defined our stances. It was three Christmases ago at a time when both of us were in school and working minimum wage jobs. We regularly would take the subway in Philadelphia. There was a man on the subway who, in addition to candy, bootleg DVDs, incense, and body oil, used to sell baby turtles. I always talked about wanting one, but I didn't have the expendable income with which to purchase one. That Christmas, Dave bought me a large turtle tank. It was a very thoughtful gift. However, he did not purchase the turtles themselves, and when asked, he admitted he wouldn't help me clean the tank. I told him I was very grateful and that I appreciated the gesture, but I didn't really want the added responsibility of caring for turtles. We returned the tank to the pet store and bought some food, litter, and a little perch for our cat, Suki. Dave has since told me that I was cold-blooded for telling him I didn't like the gift. I think it would have been cold if I kept it and didn't get any turtles for financial or stress-related reasons. If you receive an expensive gift that you won't use from a family member or friend, is it appropriate to tell them you won't use it so it can be returned?
Basically, if your spouse gives you an empty turtle tank, that's okay to deny. That's okay to say, no, thank you. And really, it's only, I think, when a spouse of some time, a partner or a spouse, a romantic person in your life where you have pledged to be open and honest with one another and maybe sharing finances, I think that's certainly a situation where you can be as cold as a cold-blooded turtle in the Philadelphia subway. But for the most part, other than that, and even then, you know, proceed with caution, because a gift is a gesture that you even if you hate the thing, the gesture is something you have to receive graciously. And certainly if it's something that is given to you by your parent, or if you are a parent and given to you by one of your children, it doesn't matter how ugly or malformed that that arts and crafts coaster is. you have to be like, yeah, I love this, because you do. You love the fact that your weird dad made you a terribly ugly arts and crafts coaster. And maybe your kids made something for you, too, like a drawing. Obviously, none of you are monsters enough to reject a gift that is given to you by your own child. Maybe one of you. Maybe one of you is. I wouldn't be surprised. Maybe one of them. It's like, no, I'm sorry.
I mean, I've thought about it.
I'm sorry, little Judge John Hodgman Jr. But that drawing of us holding hands together, I just don't see a place for it in my life. The object, and this is something that I learned from Marie Kondo, the unofficial ghost guest bailiff of every episode we ever do, which is that the gift is the gesture, and the object is just an object. And objects, unless you are 12 and you're getting toys, objects are burdens almost all the time. Jesse, do you need stuff in your life? Do you need more stuff?
No, I don't. Although I do desire more stuff.
Yeah, well, that's good, too.
I can go to the flea market myself, Judge Hodgman.
Right, exactly. I mean, most grown-ups don't need a lot more stuff. And if they do need, then a gesture that fills a need is fantastic. And that might be a true material need, like, I don't have enough food. And that's why charitable giving at the year's end, or in this case, the year's beginning, is always good. Or it might be a different kind of need, a more personal, deep need that you are unable to fulfill yourself. Give something to someone that they would never get for themselves, but they want. That's a lovely gift. But for the most part, it's just a gesture. And Marie Kondo says, once you acknowledge the gesture, both to the person, and because Marie Kondo is kind of crazy, she also suggests that you acknowledge it to the gift itself, and you talk to the inanimate object, say, I appreciate what you represent and have brought into my life. And then when you are ready, when it no longer sparks joy for you, you throw it away or give it away.
I have a vague memory that when I traveled in Japan as a 13-year-old with my 8th grade class, there was something about bringing a lot of turkey jerky to give away. So that's my knowledge of Japanese gifting culture. Always have turkey jerky on hand.
Jesse, you and I are not married.
Sadly.
Nor are we in a long-term committed romantic relationship. But I do think that as very good friends, we have pledged honesty to one another. And if you ever gave me some turkey jerky, I would throw that stuff in your fat face. I would be so mad.
Well, I mean, I did.
Just a little hint for the holidays.
A year ago.
Don't stuff my stocking with turkey jerky.
A year ago at Christmas, Judge Hodgman, I gave you perhaps the single most useless object any friend has ever gifted another friend, which was an enamel pin of a Hartford yes. Whalers Zamboni machine.
That made me so happy. That made me so happy. And it made you happy, too, because you clearly had tuned into an obsession of mine. And because of the internet, you can find something for everyone's obsession. And so that gesture was not merely, I'm thinking of you here at the end of the year, but it was also, I have been thinking about you all year long because I know you love the Hartford Whalers.
Yeah.
And also, you know what else? It was small.
Yeah.
It's a tiny thing. I love, you know, it is such an important thing that when I go on tour, that people will occasionally give me pieces of art that they've created, a hand crocheted hot dog that says I'm not a sandwich on it. Jade Gordon out in Seattle makes beautiful pictures of me and gives them to me, and I love them. And do you know what? I keep them. I really do. I keep them all, because how could you dispose of something like that? But it does mean that my chambers right now that I'm sitting in is basically, outside of this Nog tank, it is basically a hoarder's nest of gavels and illustrations of me. And it makes me very happy. By the way, I am exaggerating for comic effect. I have two gavels that have been given to me, only two. One by a friend of the show and Metafilter's own, Matt Howie, who gave me a giant gavel at the very first Max FunCon, or maybe the second. And he gave it to me. It's about the size of a small dog.
It is monstrous.
It's a very big gavel, beautifully made, and has a little plaque on it that says my name. He gave me a huge case and the opportunity to check my luggage on the way home, which was a lovely, lovely gesture, and I have it here in my office. And I just received my second gavel, the only other gavel that I've ever gotten, and it was from Isaac McNary, who is a carpenter from El Dorado, Kansas. And you may or may not recall our friend over at Stuff You Should Know podcast, one half of the great duo of the Stuff You Should Knows, Chuck Bryant, was a litigant on this show because his wife was angry at him for having done home carpentry and not knowing what he was doing. And Isaac McNary heard that show and contacted Chuck and said, I am going to come and fix the doorway into your dining room if you will let me live in your house while I do it. And Chuck said, sure. And guess what? Chuck didn't get murdered by the strange carpenter from El Dorado who lived in his house. Instead, Isaac came and lived there for a few days and finished the door widening project that Chuck started but couldn't finish himself. We'll post a picture of me when I visited Chuck in Atlanta in the last tour. You can see the handiwork of this gentleman, Isaac McNary. And then he also gave to Chuck a gavel that he had made for me. And guess what? This gavel was regular size in a beautiful case that he made himself. And these are beautiful, beautiful gestures and beautiful objects as well. And insofar as you are going to give a gift, bear in mind that the gesture is more important than the thing itself. And then really think about what will give the other person pleasure. And honestly, if you're not sure, I think just a note saying how much that person means to you, unless they're a 10-year-old and wants a toy, that's as good a gift as I would ever hope to receive.
Here's something from John. My wife, Becca, and I are the parents of twin 10-year-old boys and a 12-year-old daughter. We take a ski vacation every January on a non-school vacation week. These trips are fantastic fun. Condo, food, fresh air, superheated outdoor pools, drinks with friends. They're among the best times we've had as a family. In the past, we've saved money and avoided crowds by going off-peak. We usually go Monday through Thursday and are back at school on Friday. Becca feels skipping school for a ski trip is scandalous. We've struck a compromise. Our daughter will stay home, since middle school covers too much material in 4 days for her to miss. Becca has now tried to further erode this year's trip, since one of the twin boys has ear surgery scheduled for the week after the ski trip. If he goes on the trip, he'll miss a total of 8 days for both surgery and ski trip. I say, let the ski trip proceed since it's all paid for and Andrew will have the time of his life before having to go into surgery. Becca says, cancel. Judge Hodgman, what's your verdict?
I almost need to recuse myself due to an intense bias against skiing that goes back to my elementary school days in Brookline, Massachusetts. As you know, I am not a skier because skiing is arguably a sport and I am not a sports person. And for many of my early sedentary years, my only experience with skiing was going on one cross-country ski trip with my class in Massachusetts, and I fell down, and getting up, I broke the ski pole, and I said, that's it for me. I accept that it is a beautiful, beautiful sport and a very enjoyable thing to do and a great way to be out in nature, but there was a big class divide in Brookline between those who would leave during school vacations and go skiing, and those who would stay home and roll multi-sided die and watch Doctor Who. I was obviously in the latter group. The kids who went skiing tended to be, I mean, this was at the height of preppydom, and they tended to have a little bit more money. They were a little bit more, you know, skiing involves buying a lot of expensive gear, and they had the most expensive gear, and they would go away and come back with weird raccoon suntans from the snow glare or whatever, where the sunlight hit their part of their faces that weren't covered by the fancy goggles, and they would always wear their ski lift tickets still on their expensive parkas like these little merit badges of jerkism. And I just I'm sure there may be people out there who I went to elementary school with and who went skiing and are now feeling very hurt by the fact that I have sophomorically nurtured this grudge. But I just have an association of skiing with something the rich kids who made me uncomfortable did. And so I'm just gonna take myself out of this for a moment, Jesse, and ask you what you think.
I have such deep ski trip class resentments that are based on the rich kid middle school that I went to in Hillsboro, California, some 20 minutes south of my home in inner city San Francisco. And I got to go on a couple of ski trips thanks to the generosity of a teacher who was nice enough to overcharge the other children so that I could be offered a free spot on the ski trip. But I think by the time I was about 15, I figured out what had been going on when I was in middle school and came to resent skiing so much, so deeply and profoundly, that I'm unable to render a reasonable judgment on this matter. And in fact, I would also say that I would have to recuse myself just on the basis of this being something that involves skipping school. And as a person who both had to skip school frequently because of disability, and as someone who basically never stopped hating school, I even within my family, I have to recuse myself on school matters and defer to my wife, who liked school and was good at it, because I just go blind with rage just at the thought of just the word homework makes my eyes cross and kind of like a gray scrim to be pulled down across my field of vision.
Let me understand, Jesse. What button is the skipping school issue in this case pushing for you? You want these kids to skip school because you hate school so much, or you don't think they should skip school?
It is both. That's what makes it so difficult. I both want these kids to skip school because I hate school and I think it's dumb. and sorry, children who are listening to this, but it's God's own truth. And so I think they're not going to lose anything. But then I also have these deep traumas related to missing big chunks of school, especially before the current class of migraine medications that I take came out, and having to make up schoolwork for time that I was out of school. I just remember being so upset. Can't I just skip that? Do I have to do double homework whenever I'm healthy?
Right.
So I'm both paths lead to deep trauma and not rationality.
Well, congratulations, John, for crafting a case that would cause a neurotic breakdown in both me and Jesse. We are now curled up in fetal positions here in the eggnog tank, and I'm barely clearing my nostrils to be able to breathe and talk to you now. You really brought up a lot of stuff from the bottom of the eggnog tank, as it were, and it's come to the surface. And you can hear and worry that you might not get a fair shake here in the court of Judge John Hodgman. But I am able to be impartial, and I will give you my ruling. But then I'm gonna say some things that you have to listen to. You should go on this ski trip for two reasons. One, you like skiing, and I can't stop you from that. And I bet you if I went skiing with you, I would like it too. But two, and most importantly, it's paid for already. You are already engaging in an activity that is not open to a lot of people for financial reasons, because skiing involves expensive equipment, travel and obviously the cost of lift tickets and everything else. It is not a cheap thing to be doing. I would hate to feel that that money, which you have already thrown at the prospect of going down a hill fast, would be wasted. And you don't even get to go down the hill fast. And yet, I will say this and add this to my order. Go, but stop doing what you're doing. I'm not saying stop skiing, but going off season to save money, which is very frugal and thrifty of you. And I'm not making any judgments about where you are in your financial life. Obviously, it's important to you to be frugal, but it's more important for your children to go to school. Now, in years past, you are absolutely right to take your children out of school. First grade, kindergarten through about third grade, that's playtime anyway. They might as well be skiing in school at that point. And it's also their kids, and they don't understand. But now you sense, you know already, that it's different now. Your daughter's in middle school. She's actually got real schoolwork to do. And if you were in New York City, your 10-year-olds couldn't be skipping fifth grade now because they wouldn't get into a middle school, even a public middle school that they wanted to go to, because attendance is one of the only measurements of your one of the only measurements that public middle schools use to determine who gets to go there and who doesn't. But set aside the absolute insanity of the middle school application process in New York City. Wherever you live, I'm sure you have great schools, private or public. It's not a problem. But your kids are at a point now where they are, if they're not already, they should be encouraged to take their schooling seriously, not just as school, but as a responsibility in their life. And you're already taking your kids on a ski trip. You don't want to start training them to believe that the rules don't matter for them, or that the consequences of skipping their responsibilities don't matter to them, because that makes bad people. And you don't want, your kids are great. You don't want them to be bad people. You don't want them to think, yeah, all those other kids have to go to school, but my family goes skiing and I get an extra long vacation. That to me is the epitome of what would bother me about the kids who came back with lift tickets on their jackets. They would usually go during school vacations, but what got to me was there. I would see them, and I'd be like, there are no consequences in life for these kids. They're all fine. They're all fine human beings now, I'm sure. But I mean, if you are already indulging happily in a passion that is by its nature a fairly exclusive sport, you don't want to add on to the additional psychic burden of saying to your kids, yeah, the rules don't matter. We just do what we want in this family. Because that's terrible. No offense, John. But, well, maybe you're offended anyway. That's fine. So what I would say is continue your passion for skiing. If it's so meaningful to you, you are now going to have to pay money. You're going to have to feel the sacrifice of your love of this sport and the fact that you had children and you have to raise your children properly. And that means they have to go to school, and you have to go from now on during school vacations and pay the price. In life, there are prices to be paid. And you all need to learn that together through skiing.
We'll have more Judge John Hodgman when we come back in just a second. You're listening to Judge John Hodgman. I'm Bailiff Jesse Thorne. Of course, the Judge John Hodgman podcast, always brought to you by you, the members of MaximumFun.org. Thanks to everybody who's gone to MaximumFun.org/join. And you can join them by going to MaximumFun.org/join. The Judge John Hodgman podcast is also brought to you this week by Aura Frames.
Hey, Mother's Day is coming up. Do you have a mom in your life that you'd like to celebrate? There are very few better ways than giving an Aura frame to someone you care about. These are beautifully Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos of your memories with your mom, stepmom, a mentor, friend, whatever it is in your life who might enjoy seeing photos from your life. Aura frames are the way to go.
Judge, there's a very special mom in my life, Ms. Teresa Thorne.
Yes.
That's my wife, and also a whole human being in her own right. Guess what's on her bedside table? Yes, that's right. You guessed it in one, an Aura frame. What I love about the Aura frame is
you don't have to load a bunch of stuff onto an SD card or whatever, like with the old digital frames. It is so easy to get the pictures on there. So like when Teresa texts me a cute picture of one of our children or our dog, or one of our siblings texts us a cute picture of one of them or one of their children, all I have to do is hit that share button on my phone and I can share it right to the frame and then it lives there for as long as I want. I can also take it off whenever I want, but I don't even have to open the Aura Frames app, which is a great app, but I don't even have to go there. It just goes straight into wherever I want it, whichever frame I want, or I have multiple Aura Frames in my house or all of them. It is incredibly easy. That's why Wirecutter chose it as the best digital photo frame. That's why it's one of Oprah's favorite things. It is guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages.
Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame.
That's A-U-R-A frames.com. Use the code Hodgman at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. The Judge John Hodgman podcast is also brought to you this week by Stitch Fix.
You know that boost of confidence you get when you put on an outfit that just feels good? You know what that's like. That's what I get when I use Stitch Fix. With Stitch Fix, you get a human stylist, not AI. A human being who understands your style, size, and budget. They do all the shopping for you, and it's the easiest way to update your wardrobe this season or any other.
This professional stylist picks the clothes. They can either send you a box where anything you don't want is unbelievably easy to return, or they can make a little storefront for you just from stuff that they recommend for your taste and your body. It is an absolutely incredible service. They give you styling advice, outfit recommendations, the whole thing, soup to nuts. And like I said, if you don't want it, if you don't like it, it is unfathomably easy to send it back. They give you an envelope that's big enough, that has the postage and the labels on it. All you have to do is shove the thing in there, close it up, and drop it off at your local mailing center. It is that easy.
Can I also say the stuff that my stylist at Stitch Fix picks for me, I really like it. Like, they know me, and it's really terrific. Plus, if you've got small people in your life, sadly, my small people are now adults shopping for themselves. But if you've got little kids, it's a terrific way to get togs for your kids. Style that makes you feel as you want to look. Get started today at stitchfix.com/JJHO. That's stitchfix.com/JJHO. stitchfix.com/JJHO.
Hi, this is Biz, and this is the final season of One Bad Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting. This is going to be a year of celebrating all that makes this podcast and this community magical.
I'm so glad that I found your podcast.
I just cannot thank you enough for just being the voice of reason as I'm trying to figure all of this out.
Thank you, and cheers to your incredible show and the vision you had to provide this space for all of us.
This is still a show about life after giving life. And yes, there will be swears. You can find us on MaximumFun.org. And as always, you are doing a great job.
All right, class, tomorrow's exam will cover the extinction and de-extinction of the dodo, PowerPoint as an art form, and the history of Eurovision. Any questions? Yes, you in the back.
What is this?
It's the podcast Let's Learn Everything, where we learn about science and a bit of everything else.
My name's Tom. I study cognitive and computer science, but I'll also be your teacher for intermediate emojis.
My name's Caroline, and I did my master's in biodiversity conservation, and I'll be teaching you intro to things the British Museum stole.
My name's Ella. I did a PhD in stem cell biology, so obviously I'll be teaching you the history of fan fiction.
Class meets every other Thursday on Maximum Fun.
So do I still get credit for this?
No.
Obviously not.
No.
It's a podcast.
Welcome back to the Judge John Hodgman podcast. We're clearing the docket. Here's something from Melissa. I wish to submit for the court's deliberation a dispute I have with my best friend Casey. The disagreement concerns the proper course of action when one is attacked by a shark. Casey alleges that the best self-defense is to punch it in the nose. Based on my own extensive research and common sense, I say the correct response is to poke it in the eyes.
Casey recently moved to California, one of the world's major hotspots for great white shark attacks. Furthermore, he's expressed the intent to buy a boat. Should he follow through, I have no doubt he'll be torn to shreds within the year. I turn to his honor. I'm seeking something along the lines of an injunction which orders Casey to poke sharks in the eyes in the instance of an attack, or perhaps a ruling of mental incompetence and appointment of a marine biologist to serve as his legal guardian. Please, help me protect my friend from his two worst enemies, sharks and himself.
Well, shark attacks, of course, get a lot of attention on the in the very rare instances that they occur. The likelihood is that your friend would sooner be attacked by a shark on the highway than attacked by a shark in an airplane. And even those two things are more likely than being attacked by a shark in the ocean, statistically speaking. That's
it's more likely science. It's more likely, in according to my calculations, that he'll be attacked by one of those singing and dancing sharks from the Katy Perry Super Bowl halftime show than that he will be attacked by a great white shark while in his ship a sea.
Yeah, because those dancers who are made to wear shark outfits, they're angry.
Yeah, they're resentful
of it. They have not forgotten. And they have, for some reason, not been allowed to take off their costumes. So
they're sweaty. They're even angrier now. They're dehydrated. When they get dehydrated, they get disoriented. And when they get disoriented, they get belligerent.
And what do you do in the rare instance in which a shark attacks you or a dancer in a shark costume who has not been allowed to eat or drink for several months? You punch him in the nose. Look, this is what you do. You punch a shark in the nose. How do I know this? Well, I mentioned Chuck Bryant before. He and Josh Clark host the great podcast, Stuff You Should Know. And I know that they went over this and they said the old legend is true. You punch a shark in the nose, the shark goes away. And I actually texted Chuck to verify my memory of this. And I said, does that really work, punching a shark in the nose? And his text said, yep. And then his next text said, disturbs electroreceptors in nose. Chuck is a man of short texts. And then, just to be fair, I said, thank you. Better than stabbing it in the eyes? And Chuck wrote back saying, I imagine that would work well, too. So you're not wrong, Melissa. Obviously, poking a shark in its dead doll's eyes is going to be uncomfortable for the shark. But you're forgetting two things, and it might drive the shark away. Maybe as effectively as punching in the nose, maybe even more effectively. But you're forgetting two things. One is the position of the eyes on the shark. The eyes of the shark are not on its head, but deep inside its stomach. That's shark biology. That's not true. It's on the side of its head. And if a shark is coming for you, Guess how it's coming for you. Nose first, because its mouth is under it. It's not sidling up to you to give you the fish eye. If you're going to poke that shark's eyes, you're somehow going to have to get around to the side of the shark or the other side of the shark. And I don't think the shark is going to give you that opportunity, to be perfectly honest. And second, the other thing you're overlooking is punching a shark in the nose is great. That's funny. That's funnier than poking them in the eyes. You're punching a shark in the nose. How many times do I have to say that sentence before you accept the wonderful, humiliating beauty of this eating meat tube and this monster of destruction from the depths coming at you, and you go boop in the nose. Wah, goes the shark, because they're crybabies. That's a wonderful comedic upending of power with the simple boop. Compared to that, poking in the eye, forget it. I mean, I'm talking about Buster Keaton style comedy here. You're talking about the Three Stooges. You know nothing about sharks. Get out of my courtroom.
I'm completely hung up on the idea of sharks sidling up to you. I feel like Judge Hodgman, if those listeners who are listening right now and like me are from the undersea inner city, they know how to spot a shark who's on the roll up.
Right.
If you see a shark on the roll up, you know you're about to get jacked. And the way they do it is they sidle up next to you.
They sidle up. It's the only way they can see you because their dead doll's eyes are on the sides of their long, smooth meatheads.
Here's something from Jeff. A respectful correction on the credit given to the Broadway musical Grease as the instigator of the 1970s revival of 1950s culture. You mentioned...
Okay, now I'm just going to jump in just to say I'm really glad you wrote, Jeff, because I really got this all wrong. I got it all chronologically wrong. So I'm going to let Jeff take this one and school me, the judge.
You mentioned Sha Na Na being a result of the revival, when in fact it's the other way around. You may recall that Sha Na Na played at Woodstock and had been doing that whole shtick since the 1960s. It has been said that Grease was inspired by Sha Na Na. It could even be argued that Sha Na Na are the prototypal or prototypical hipsters, those relishing in the youth culture of the relatively recent past. I cannot think of an earlier example of this phenomenon, so I feel it's important to give the credit where it is due.
And Jeff, you're absolutely right, and I'm sorry that I gave the impression that Grease led to Sha Na Na, but I will point out that there were two phases of Sha Na Na. There was Sha Na Na at Woodstock, and then there was Sha Na Na with its syndicated television program. And although they are the same band, and I believe technically, there's still a Sha Na Na with two of the original members out there making music. Look them up. Although John Bowser Bauman is no longer affiliated with the group. And the guy who played Santini, remember the middle-aged bald greaser who was a member of the group? He's a medical doctor in Los Angeles now. And I've been thinking about making an appointment just to see him. But Sha Na Na, of course, was this group. They did 50 songs and they dressed up like greasers, even though by the late 70s, at the height of their fame with their syndicated television variety program, they were all probably in, 35 to 40 years old. They're all, for the most part, graduates of Columbia University here in New York City. They had begun as an a cappella group called the Kingsmen, and then they started doing some of this, what I want to say, old-timey doo-wop, but it wasn't even that old-timey at that point. They were only... 15 years, a decade or 15 years out from the heyday of that classic rock and roll music. But of course, the culture had been wildly transformed between 1955 and 1965, as you know from watching Mad Men. And by the time they played Woodstock, they were this bizarre curiosity who basically were reviving a music that the entire generation there had purposefully shoved aside in favor of electric rock music of the 60s. Sha Na Na, by the 70s, at the height of their fame, and I say this with deep respect because those guys had the chops. They were real performers. They were funny. That variety show was very meaningful to a 8 or 9 year old. And that's where it stops because it was a show about 45 year old greasers for 9 year old boys. And that's a great thing, but it was a little corny by the time they got there. And by the time they got there in 1979, of course, Grease had come out or had just come out almost simultaneously. It certainly had been on Broadway. And this whole 50s revival thing was a larger cultural moment. But and they were kind of along for the ride with it. And when it went out of fashion, so did they. But Jeff points out something that I forgot about, and I regret that I misled you all in this great cultural moment that was Sha Na Na, and specifically Sha Na Na at Woodstock. When we say that Sha Na Na played Woodstock, it's often like, can you believe this weird novelty group played Woodstock? But it is worth going onto your internet to see their performance at Woodstock. Because this was no longer, or I shouldn't say, they were not yet the sort of corny children's novelty group that they became in the late 70s. At Woodstock, they were, as I say, performing music that had been purposefully rejected by their peers. And in ways that anticipated, the Ramones were digging into really basic, hard-rocking rock songs from the 50s and playing them at a very fast tempo, faster than the original recordings. And they were not saying peace and love. They were saying, let's go to the top manically. at the top of their lungs and dancing in gold jumpsuits. And frankly, it's one of the most punk rock things I've ever seen committed to film, because they did not belong there and they knew it and they did not hold back. And that performance of Let's Go to the Hop is truly weird and magical. I regret if I misled you in my brief cultural history of the 50s revival in the 1970s. Sha Na Na is obviously an important part of it, and I would be remiss if I did not mention as well our good friend Jesse Andy Daly on another podcast network, as they used to say in the 1970s on talk shows, on another network. Andy recorded a series of incredible podcasts called the Andy Daly Podcast Pilot Project, in which he ostensibly was reviewing pilot podcasts that had been sent in by anonymous strangers trying to get onto this network, when in fact they were all him playing many of his different characters. And there is one episode, you know the one I'm talking about.
Yes.
In which the character is Wolfman Hot Dog, who is a surfer and 50s music enthusiast who also works at the Hertz station in Santa Monica. And it is his lifelong dream here in 2015 or 2014 when it was recorded. His lifelong dream, or now 2016 when you're listening to it. Oh, time passes. It is here in the present day his dream to join Sha Na Na, the greatest interpreters of traditional American rock music, which he believes are still at the height of their fame, but they're not, obviously. And it is not for children, this podcast, because Andy is an adult entertainer and there are some adult themes and references. But if you are a grown-up man or woman of the age 9 or up, no, I mean, you know, 18 and up, and can handle some adult themes and references, Wolfman Hot Dog, Andy Daly as Wolfman Hot Dog, writes an assessment of what it would be like for him if he were to ever join Sha Na Na and move into the Sha Na Na house, which is the embodiment of his dream. There is no Sha Na Na house, but he believes there is.
He believes that they all live in a house together.
He believes they all live in a house together and they're just having the greatest time. And it is one of the most hilarious and painfully poignant, self-deluded bits of comedy monologue that I've ever heard. I mean, Andy isn't self-deluded, but the character of Wolfman Hot Dog is so self-deluded. It is, you know, Andy has created many, many genius things, including his TV show on Comedy Central Review, but this to me is the, explains why Andy Daly is so great. And so,
isn't there a water skiing element to it? Isn't he a champion water skier?
That's what it was. He's not a surfer. He's a champion water skier. I can't believe I...
And he wants to incorporate water skiing into Sha Na Na's act.
Yeah, right, exactly. I can't believe that I made that mistake, because, of course, in the world of Wolfman Hot Dog, water skiers and surfers hate one another and are constantly getting into rumbles, but it's nothing compared. It's not. And then there's a separate side rivalry between the ocean water skiers and the lake water skiers, and they hate each other. Oh, it's a beautiful piece of recorded comedy that's the brand new year. Listen to some new things, even if they're old and were recorded a couple of years ago.
Okay.
But there you go.
We have one last thing here, something from a high school teacher named Eric. Eric teaches at a high school where the students are court ordered to attend. And he was teaching a course on expository or persuasive writing. And
Wait a minute. They're court ordered to attend high school?
Yeah, exactly. I think it was probably for students who have had legal troubles.
Why don't they just skip school and go skiing?
Yeah.
Like the best people.
Yeah. I think a lot of people at that high school show up in a ski parka with the lift tickets hanging off.
With the lift tickets still on there? Yeah. So, in any case, he works with kids who have had some troubles.
Yes,
like,
exactly. And he used in his persuasive writing class the prompt, "Is a hot dog a sandwich?" And one of his students named Carl wrote an essay on the topic. And it's an essay in the form of a letter to a friend.
And Jesse, before you read the letter, when Eric wrote to me, it was a very touching letter, because he said that Carl is one of the quieter kids in his class and has had very difficult time engaging in schoolwork and tuning in to what is being asked of him. But when the question of whether a hot dog was a sandwich was posed by Eric to the class, Carl really got excited about it and insisted upon writing this letter. And I insisted with Carl's permission that we allow it to be shared with the Judge John Hodgman listening audience because we all know what is a sandwich, right? So, Jesse, with that, take it away.
As an American, I'm a born expert on hot dogs. I've been eating them all my life, for real. And because of this, I know that a hot dog is not a sandwich. It is a hot dog. Hot dogs are in their own category of food.
Go on, Carl.
A sandwich is two pieces of bread. In between those pieces of bread might be some mayonnaise, some tomatoes, some lettuce, and some bologna. It's like someone trying to say that you're making a bologna sandwich without lettuce and mayo. It would still be a sandwich because that's what it's been called for years and years. We can't change history. Even the Hot Dog and Sausage Council states that a hot dog is not a sandwich. These are experts in the area of hot dogs. And if there's a higher hot dog authority, I don't know what it is. Hot dog buns specifically state that they are for hot dogs only. Bread
now,
can be used
let me
for... Go ahead.
Let me interrupt you right there. I've heard a lot of arguments about why a hot dog is or is not a sandwich. But as far as I'm concerned, Carl is breaking completely new ground here in this research area. I had not considered this particular argument about hot dog buns saying that they're for hot dogs. So thank you, Carl. Read on, Jesse.
Bread can be used for any sandwich. For hot dog buns, however, the package does not say sandwich buns. It says hot dog buns. So even the bread industry itself recognizes that hot dogs are their own thing. If I'm at a cookout and someone offers me a hot dog sandwich, I'm going to look at them like they're stupid. That would ruin my entire cookout experience. I would go home hungry and angry, and I would never go to another one of their ridiculous cookouts. Yours in hot dogs, Carl.
I think that that's fantastic. I do think, Carl, that you might want to work on not getting too upset at cookouts. I mean, I agree with you. If someone offers you a hot dog sandwich, that sounds weird and dumb, but I wouldn't want it to ruin your entire experience. Sometimes in life, Carl, people say things because they're ignorant. And you should still be able to enjoy a cookout.
Yeah, I mean, so enjoying a cookout is one of our fundamental rights as an American. Don't let them take that away from you just by saying something ridiculous.
Don't go home hungry and angry on principle alone. Certainly not this principle in any case. But Carl and Eric, I just want to say thank you very much for sharing that. It was really meaningful to me that it sparked some discussion in the classroom. There's a reason that people talk about this. It is maybe one of the most timeless questions. It's so perplexing that we still are talking about it, even though it's a dumb question. Still, it captures the imagination, and it makes me very happy, Carl, that you wrote that and were willing to share it with us. So I say thank you.
Here's what Eric said in closing his letter. He wrote, "I wanted to thank you for putting this topic into the ether of my classroom. You never know what's going to spark interest in young people. Turns out he feels passionately about sandwiches and hot dogs." So thank you so much for sharing that with us, Carl. And thank you, Eric, for sending it to us.
I did put it into the ether of his classroom, but I didn't think he would notice because I was told the ether was odorless.
Yeah.
I've been piping. I should let you know, as a social experiment, I have piped in various toxic and anesthetic gases into a number of high school classrooms around the country and just to see what happens.
Right.
See if I can affect the young minds.
Right. It's called the Curious George Project.
That's exactly so. Oh, that chimpanzee ate a puzzle piece. And he had to go to the hospital. What a portrait of a different engagement with healthcare. He swallowed a puzzle piece. He was put under, first of all, a beautiful lady nurse took him to go see the mans who were going to operate on him. And then he had to have an operation And they put him under general anesthesia, and he had to live in the hospital for a week afterward. That would totally be an outpatient procedure by now, right? That would be, you'd get that done, you'd get that done in a urban MD walk-in clinic.
They would remove just, that puzzle piece laparoscopically.
They'd probably just punch you in the stomach until you vomited it up. And then and then you'd have a $500 copay. Thanks, Obama.
And they say the Republicans don't have a health care plan. Judge John Hodgman is produced by Julia Smith and edited by Mark McConville. If you've got a case for Judge John Hodgman, go to MaximumFun.org/JJHO. That's MaximumFun.org/JJHO and share it with us there. No case too big or small. We review them all. You can follow us on social media. We are on Twitter. John is at Hodgman. I am at Jesse Thorne. We have a lively MaximumFun.org Facebook group and Reddit page. You can search for those on Facebook and Reddit. MaximumFun.reddit.com is where the Reddit discussions go down. It is basically the only polite place on the entire internet. Well, we'll talk to you next time on the Judge John Hodgman podcast.
Happy New Year!
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.